Hi, I'm Nicholas McKay, and this podcast is brought to you by my colleagues Salma Atallah, Carl Dagger, and myself, students at the Technical University of Munich Department of Science, Technology, and Society.
We're talking about mismanagement and mishandlement at every step of the way, from the highest level of the hierarchy to the smallest employee at the port.
They are 100% avoidable.
In the end, it's politics.
There is perhaps no greater story to illustrate the benefits and risks of science and technology than that of German chemist Fritz Haber. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1918 for his invention of the Haber-Bosch process, which enabled scientists to transform the nitrogen present in our atmosphere into ammonia, allowing crops to absorb the compound's nitrogen molecules much needed for their growth. Effectively, Haber was able to create, quote, bread from the air, unquote, as the press described the achievement at the time. The Haber-Bosch process is essentially what allowed the world population to grow to today's figure of 7.7 billion. But Haber's peers were not too happy that he won the Nobel Prize, for he was also involved in some nasty business. He had invented chlorine gas, which was used in the trenches of World War I by the German army and was responsible for the gruesome deaths of thousands of Allied soldiers. He also invented the deadly pesticide Zyklon, which was later used by the Nazis in their gas chambers during the Holocaust. And in a cruel twist of fate, Haber's invention claimed the lives of some of his own relatives. Haber's story illustrates the duality of a scientist's work, or how science can be used for good and bad. Through that lens, this podcast episode looks at how society manages life in the face of this duality. Specifically, we look at an item classified as dual use, ammonium nitrate. Born out of the Haber-Bosch process, ammonium nitrate is a popular fertilizer used all around the world, but also a dangerous explosive that has claimed many lives. But before we zoom in on ammonium nitrate, let's start with a general question. Items are classified as dual use to manage their benefits and risks. So how does that classification happen?
In the case of what typically would happen is that government that is interested in these things would consult with experts, scientists, and so on, and would come up with what they would consider a dual use item. And the militaries can be involved in the process as well, because there is expertise in this respect.
This is Dr. Francesco Amodio, Associate Professor of Economics at McGill University in Montreal. His research focuses on constraints for economic growth and entrepreneurship in low-income countries. He has looked into the effects of security-motivated trade restrictions on economic activity in the West Bank, so he knows a few things about dual-use material.
It's very difficult to say where you draw the line and consider something dual use versus not. And, you know, in the case of chemicals, a lot of it has to do with the concentration of things. So you may not want to ban a chemical overall, but you may want to ban it if the concentration is higher than this much per milliliter. What I'm saying is that there is several ways of drawing that line. In the end, it's politics, but these decisions are informed by experts in various domains.
Let's hear what these experts have to say about ammonium nitrate. We'll start with Dr. Hans Passmann, Emeritus Professor in Chemical Risk Management at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands.
Ammonium nitrate is a very good fertilizer because it contains so much nitrogen and the plants need nitrogen. There are other alternatives, but, well, costs come in, transportation comes in, and it is, still the best and most convenient thing to have, prilled ammonium nitrate.
And prilled ammonium nitrate is what we'll find most commonly in the agricultural industry. And those prills look like
white droplets, kind of. Diameter of each droplet is something like 2, 3, 4, 5 millimeters. Usually it's all loose, so you can kind of pour it from a bag or from even from a larger load to a heap, and that's it. So for the farmer, he can fill a thing that swings around and put it on the land.
The size of the prills and the convenience with which they can be used are a major factor in the popularity of ammonium nitrate in the agricultural industry. It can be used for increasing crop yield, improving fertility of soil types, controlling growth of vegetation mass, increasing gluten and protein content in grains, and many, many more purposes. But then, how does it explode?
The prills are rather kind of small droplets, you could say. So that is rounded, etc. Now, this is the most popular mode in which ammonium nitrate nowadays is manufactured, shipped, and etc. and used. And there are two kinds, roughly. One is for fertilizer, and one is for explosives manufacture, and that is low density. There are a lot of complications because the high density can turn into low density just by thermal fluctuations.
So ammonium nitrate can actually be manufactured to be used as an explosive. When did this realization happen?
I think basically late 1950s to early 1960s in America, there's a lot of explosives used in civilian, non-military applications. And they have to do with road construction, with mining, with major earth-moving projects, with things like that. And they used to be using things like dynamite and TNT and nitroglycerin and things like that. And then they discovered in the late 1950s to early 1960s that if you mix ammonium nitrate with fuel oil and you make what's called ANFO, that it is very easy to transport. It's easy to manufacture, and first and foremost, it's cheap compared to other alternative explosive substances. So that was the basic reason why that became so popular for those industry sectors.
That was Dr. Vito Bobrowskis. He operates his own consulting and research firm called Fire Science and Technology, Inc. He also does a lot of work in forensic science, and his research delved into ammonium nitrate explosives. It comes as no surprise, then, that he has strong opinions about it.
These accidents, in my view and my analysis, and I did a lot of investigation, they are 100% avoidable. As the manufacturers, you cannot make useful ammonium nitrate safer, but what you can do is make a very modest substitution, namely substitute calcium ammonium nitrate or ammonium nitrate. Even though that is largely an ammonium nitrate-based product, there has never been an incident where a disaster occurred and somebody got blown up with the product. And there are tests, there are laboratory tests that suggest that that would be maybe not impossible, but certainly extraordinarily difficult to arrange.
Calcium ammonium nitrate is commonly referred to as CAN, C-A-N.
CAN is a substance that's possible to substitute directly for ammonium nitrate with a very slight loss of efficiency. There's a slight penalty of agricultural value, but you can then have to make a balance between agricultural value, and especially, you know, I'm sensitive because of the profession I'm into, first responders, that first responders innately have a dangerous and difficult job, and I personally think it's wrong to expose them to a gross possibility of being blown up when we don't have to do that.
Vito touches on an important point, the safety of first responders. We usually take it for granted that if we're ever caught in a disaster, natural or man-made, we can count on them to save us without giving too much thought about their lives. But one particular story paints a darker image. In August 2020, the government in Lebanon went beyond neglecting the lives of first responders. It knowingly sent them to their deaths. When a fire broke out at Beirut Port that afternoon, the city's fire brigade was called to the scene. The crew of 9 firefighters and 1 paramedic arrived to find the fire raging inside warehouse number 12, but its door was locked. As they tried to break the lock, 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate were sizzling inside the warehouse, closer to the point of exploding. Although officials knew the dangerous cargo was stored in the warehouse, and although only 2 high-ranking port officials held the keys to that lock, this information was never shared with the fire brigade. The 10-person crew met their fate at 6:07 p.m. when the chemicals exploded.
It was apocalyptic.
This is Jonathan Dagger. He's a journalist investigating the Beirut port explosion. He was also 700 meters away from warehouse number 12 at the moment of the blast. In this section of the podcast, he tells us his story. Its violent details might be triggering and cause distress to some listeners. Discretion is therefore advised.
It happened at 6.07 p.m., I think. And for a while, like there were like, because I was there, I was very close. So for the next 3 hours, I had no clue what was happening. People were saying it was a ship that blew up at the port. Some people were saying, no, it was like a bombing or a terrorist attack. And then I think the story was that there was a fireworks storage. There was a cargo of fireworks that blew up. And then that night I went home at like 9 p.m. and someone was saying, oh, there's something called ammonium nitrate that was in this hangar that blew up. And I remember there was a panic because they were like most people, I didn't know if it's toxic, like there are fumes in the sky. So there was really this rush of like, close the windows, don't stay near the windows, leave the city right now. This is going to like really harm you. So that's when that's the big dramatic entrance of ammonium nitrate as a concept into my life.
What about right before the explosion? What were you doing?
I was in a cab going from like point A to point B in a street that's parallel to the highway that's next to the port. You need to imagine like there's the port, there's a highway, and there's a street. And I was on that street, 700, 800 meters away. And I was in a cab, I was in an Uber in the back seat. And then I remember the cab just stopping because we heard this sound in the sky. And it was actually, some people thought it was airplanes. I thought it was airplanes, but I was like, no, it doesn't really sound like airplanes. And then later we understood that this might be the sound of the air being sucked in at high pressure into the hangar before the big explosion. But I remember it lasted for like a good 30 seconds. So we just all paused. And I remember the city was so quiet for 30 seconds. No one was saying a word. Everyone was really worried. And you could just tell something really bad was going to happen. And then it did. Then basically we heard this big, like earth-shattering boom. There were actually several booms because there was the echo too. But I remember like the cab started shaking. And there was like 4 or 5 seconds between hearing the sound and before the shockwave hit. And in those 4 seconds, I just had the instinct to duck. A lot of people had weird instincts. I never knew I would do that, but I did. So I just threw myself under the seat in the cab. And next thing I know, like all hell broke loose. You know, the cab just was like, it was shoved to the side. I remember it was shaking. I remember insane power, like shaking the cab for like a good 10 seconds, but it felt like way longer. And then afterwards, there was just like dust everywhere and quiet. My immediate feeling was fear. I did not know what had just happened, and I was worried that it would happen again. I thought someone had bombed the car, so I was like, oh my God, they're going to do it again. And then the dust kind of settled. You could hear the screams. You could see people like, you know, there were people bleeding. There were people who were dead on the floor, and just like buildings had collapsed. So it was purely chaos, pure panic. People were crying. I remember thinking like, this sounds a bit dramatic 2 years later, but I remember in the moment thinking, oh my God, the world has just ended. Like the scale of the explosion and being in the middle of it, you really think this is horrible.
It's horrible to even imagine. And to go back to what caused this level of destruction, it's ammonium nitrate. It's a product used for agriculture. It's supposed to give life. It is unfathomable that such a catastrophe happened. So do we know how it happened?
It's a conspiracy of silence, you know. Everyone knew that there was ammonium nitrate in Hangar 12. Everyone at the port, all the officials, almost everyone in power knew. And this is what the documents revealed. So when we talk about responsibility, we're really talking about an entire political regime that is more or less responsible in different ways. And this is just purely, like, I'm not speaking politically, I'm speaking legally. You know, the president found out a few weeks before, and his answer was, c'était trop tard. It was too late for me to do anything about it. Knowing full well that it was not too late, the least he could have done is evacuated the surroundings of the port, you know. We're talking about army command that found out in 2015 because they were asked if they would be interested in buying the ammonium nitrate, you know. These are things I brushed over. But there was a letter sent to army command in 2015 saying, hey, we have 2,750 tons of explosives sitting in the port. Would you like to buy them? And the army commander, Jean Ahouaji at the time, all he says is, no, we're not interested. And that is insane, you know, like you are commanding the Lebanese army. You are supposed to like evacuate a neighborhood if you find out there's a tiny like explosive bomb in one of the bins, you know. And you find out that in the only biggest port in the capital, there is 2,750 tons of explosives sitting around, big enough to blow up the city. And your answer is, no thanks, I don't want them. There is clear evidence of criminal negligence, of negligence that killed 230 people and injured 7,000 people and destroyed 300,000 homes and left a trauma so big, like we really struggled to overcome it. It's been 2 years and it's a city that blew up. This is Beirut. It's the capital of Lebanon. So yeah.
It's not just Beirut. This could happen anywhere else in the world. In fact, it has happened in other places. As far back as 1916 in the US and the UK, there have been dozens of accidents involving ammonium nitrate. The deadliest was in Texas City, 1947, with 581 deaths. Beirut is third with at least 218 deaths, behind Germany's Oppau with 561 deaths. In the words of Dr. Bobrowskis, they were all 100% avoidable.
The ammonium nitrate explosion safety requires you to know nothing and do nothing about the safety of explosives. It only requires one thing to be done and to be done well is fire safety. Because if the fire safety is done correctly, there is no possibility of an explosion. And if there is no possibility of explosion, measures to guard or protect against explosion are inappropriate.
So what is the regulation for storing ammonium nitrate?
A regulation for just storage of fertilizer ammonium nitrate is all over the place.
So there's no gold standard for storing it safely?
No, you know, that's the crazy part, that the only really good advice are those papers that I have published. And, you know, that's not appropriate. This should have been the people who make standards and regulations and such should be reading them and should be taking action. You know, it's nice that I can publish something and journals accept it and put it in print, but that doesn't do much good if it isn't enforced. And, you know, like one of the articles I wrote that, you know, NFPA tried to improve this standard called NFPA 400, and they did not do a good enough job. So, you know, they did some halfway measures, but it's not enough. And OSHA is even worse. You know, OSHA.
OSHA stands for Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It's a regulatory agency of the U.S. Department of Labor whose mission is to, quote, assure safe and healthy working conditions for working men and women by setting and enforcing standards and by providing training, outreach, education, and assistance, unquote.
Instead of completely revisiting their regulations and revising them according to the instructions that I would give them, they basically try to put the blame back on the industry, saying that they should have been obeying OSHA regulations in certain regards, whereas in fact, they are misquoting their own regulations, but deliberately, not by error, but deliberately trying to, you know, in American, there's this phrase, CYA, cover your ass.
That's why he advocates for replacing ammonium nitrate with other substances, such as the aforementioned CAN. But there are also others.
Now, in farming operations like in Texas, the main alternative to ammonium nitrate is urea. But urea has very different issues. And agriculturally, I don't think that agronomists would tell you it's a direct replacement. That, in other words, there are situations where you can change from using ammonium nitrate to using urea, but it requires very different techniques for application. There's weather issues that are very different for urea usage and application. And ammonium nitrate is only considered to be ideal fertilizer in certain agricultural zones. And like in America, for instance, there are states which are heavy users of ammonium nitrate, and there are states where basically the usage is nil. And my understanding is that that's because of soil and weather conditions that make other choices more appropriate or more desirable.
But there seems to be an over-reliance on ammonium nitrate in agriculture. A few months ago, when Russia, the largest exporter of ammonium nitrate, temporarily suspended all exports, the repercussions were felt worldwide. With crops already suffering from a harsh winter, compounding geopolitical tensions, and a military invasion in Ukraine, food prices soared, and shortages were felt everywhere. So how feasible is it to just phase out ammonium nitrate?
Certain countries in Europe have actually, either by government regulation or by industry sector action, in that country replaced ammonium nitrate with CAN. This is not a situation where we need to put citizens behind a buffer zone from the explosion. This is a situation where we can and should and must eliminate 100% the possibility of an explosion. And we can do that.
So what is the best recommendation you can give to eradicate ammonium nitrate accidents?
If you basically went to non-combustible buildings, avoided commingling and combustible goods, and transitioned from AN to CAN, nobody would be getting killed from ammonium nitrate explosions. So I would recommend that we should do that.
Dr. Hans Passmann goes above and beyond that recommendation.
UNICE, that is the UN ECE in Geneva, had a program earlier this year, or it was late last year, whatever, to spread the word to a lot of countries that have to deal with ammonium nitrate. And well, Beirut was a kind of incentive to this, to talk about what they should do to keep it safe. And, of course, it is not that you keep it safe only for contactless combustibles and so on, but you keep it also locked. And there is, of course, ideas, can we get rid of ammonium nitrate and can we get something more from fertilizer point of view? Same thing, but more safe. Or rather, the fertilizer industry says ammonium nitrate is safe, but can you get something inherently safe?
So store safely, regulate, educate, and phase out. Dr. Francesco Amodio has another suggestion.
I think advocating for transparency in how decisions are made with respect to dual-use items is key, so that independent of the actual final decision that is reached, we can actually get a sense of how it was reached and who were the interested parties involved, who were the expert consulted that had been consulted, and so on, so that, you know, governments are accountable for the kind of decisions they make. That's unambiguously good. You know, more transparency in how these decisions are made on this matter is unambiguously good.
Unambiguously good. So if we advocate for transparency in dealing with dual-use material, we could get better accountability. And accountability means more incentives for decision-makers and experts to do better. But let's assume for a second that all those recommendations were followed in Beirut. Could we have had a different outcome?
When we talk about the ammonium nitrate that was stored at the port, we're talking about mismanagement and mishandlement at every step of the way, from the highest level of the hierarchy to the smallest employee at the port. And when we talk about that, we put aside the alleged intentions of bringing in the ammonium nitrate. We put aside all the story of the smuggling and the ship and whether or not they were supposed to enter or not. But once they were in the port of Beirut, if we just look at that, we can see how badly they were stored. I mean, we had torn bags, they were spilling out on the floor, they were decaying for years. And as a first, that is one of the easiest things that we could have avoided. That is one of the easiest situations that could have been avoided, regardless of the legal aspects around the ammonium nitrate. What strikes me too is that in the course of 7 years of the ammonium nitrate being stored in the port of Beirut, a lot of people knew it was an open secret, and yet no one spoke out publicly about this. Yes, some people did send letters to their superiors, some superiors sent letters to the judiciary, but at a certain moment when nothing is happening, no one had the political conscience, the ethics, the will to go out and inform the public and inform the media and say something and to alert basically the public that there is a ticking time bomb in the middle of a very busy city.
So even when everything is done by the book, there can still be some blind spots within the bureaucratic messiness of government, regulation, and enforcement. Jonathan is saying that is where ammonium nitrate safety comes down to personal ethics and whistleblowing. But then, how can we explain the lack of whistleblowing in Beirut? Is everyone at the port unethical and callous?
That can only be the result of another culture, a culture of fear, a culture of silencing, a culture of corruption that stifles, that turns a blind eye. How can anyone flag anything when they don't even consider it to be dangerous, don't even consider it to be wrong, don't even consider it to be corrupt? And I think this is why ammonium nitrate was never flagged. And I think when we talk about whistleblowing, in the case of the Beirut port, we are talking about a much graver problem that has to do with deep, deep corruption that controls the way politics is handled at the port of Beirut and at the government at large. And that is why we never heard of anything.
But if we say that, aren't we resigning ourselves to fate? If the problem is so deeply rooted that even whistleblowing is not possible, what on earth can we do?
I think it's important that citizens, that government employees, that anyone working within the hierarchical system flag any issue that they consider a threat to public safety. And if they're not able to flag this within their own institutions, then they should do this on a public level. They should take the risk, in my opinion. They should take the risk and alert the public about a threat as grave as 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate sitting in a port waiting to explode at any moment. Because the truth is, had anyone done that in the past 7 years, we could have averted a major crisis, a major catastrophe.
So we can add whistleblowing at all costs to that list I mentioned earlier. It is interesting to note that even when these materials are governed with thorough technical recommendations, sound regulation, and proper enforcement, there can still be blind spots. Without ethics, political conscience, and a societal will to safely manage ammonium nitrate, a dangerous level of risk will always be there. Rationalizing the problem as both social and technical could help us overcome the limitations of a purely technocratically managed risk system, maximizing the benefits of our dual-use materials and minimizing their dangers. I'm Nicholas McKay, and this was brought to you by my colleagues Salma Atalla, Carl Dagger, and myself. We thank you for listening and hope you enjoyed this podcast.